sound poetry. This is an Englishman, Bob Cobbin. Adventure, aventure, aventureux, adventure, aventure, aventureuse, adventurous, à l'aventure, dire la bonne aventure, aventurier, aventurière, aveugle, aveugle, à l'aveuglette. Bombast, bombast, bom, bom, bombast, bombast, en phase, en phase, bombast, en phase, bombast, Phoebus. Krisop, 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 ringestammen, ringestammen, tak, 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 gros temps, gros temps, gros temps, 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 tenterre, tenterre, plume de ma tante, tu dors, tu dors, elle dort, elle dort, toc, 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 tu dors, zzz, zzz, zzz. Grin, 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 gay green, gray green. Gangrene, ganglia, grin, grin, grin.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Today's guests are the distinguished experimental filmmaker Rose Lauder and her partner Alan Alcide Sudra. Welcome to the show, Rose and Alan. Thank you for coming in. I was going to call you a French experimental filmmaker, Rose, but that's perhaps not quite strictly true.
Well,
do you have a French passport?
I have three passports.
Uh-huh, okay.
So it's a little bit difficult to distinguish because the first 18 years were spent in Peru,
right,
in Miraflores, which used to be a sort of village outside Lima, but which now is a very expensive suburb of Lima. And then I have an English passport because my parents were British, mm-hmm, and they registered me at the council or whatever you had down there. And then, of course, Alain is French, so I could have French nationality as well.
But you work mostly from France in Avignon, don't you? You and Alan are the co-founders of the Archives of Experimental Film in Avignon, which was started when, roughly, or even precisely?
Well, I started to screen films in 76, but we hadn't thought of the archives straight away. We ran screenings for about 6 years. We founded an association, had a very general title, which was Pratique Recherche Etude Artistique, in other words, practice and research of artistic practices.
Yeah.
But that caused a lot of confusion because we continued to have people asking for drawing classes and painting classes and sculpture classes and I don't know what else. So, and we tried to collaborate with some musicians and with some artistic practices, but that didn't work very well because they always hoped we'd finance their practice, and they didn't really pull their weight for finding a way of financing it.
Just to sort of rewind a bit then, but you were in London in the 60s, weren't you?
Yes, I mean, I came to London to study.
Right.
So I was in what was the Regent Street Polytechnic in those days, doesn't exist anymore, than Chelsea School of Art, which still exists, but at a different scale to when I was there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I worked in the industry, for the film industry, for about 10 years as an editor.
Right. So you set out to be a practicing artist. I think you did say to me the other day that one of your teachers is actually Frank Auerbach. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I went to the Tate yesterday and I saw paintings on the wall by quite a few artists who were, in fact, our teachers as well. And then I keep on meeting names. I think even in the installation, there was one person there who I seem to remember in the cutting rooms next to me.
Oh, really?
And,
okay.
So
is that the John Acompra installation?
Yes.
Yeah, which is actually quite impressive. Interestingly, I mean, as it happens, that's an installation at Tate Britain by John Acompra, who was a member of the Black Audio Film Collective. And the installation sort of shows the history of black people in Britain, really, doesn't it? Starting with the sort of Windrush boat that came over. And it's a lot of archive footage. I mean, I thought it was quite an impressive installation.
Well, it's also a lot of a reflection on the problems of being black and going to Oxford and trying to fit in with a...
Yeah, it's about Stuart Hall, of course, isn't it? Mostly it's the voice of Stuart Hall and his observations. But Alan, you are the sort of a bit of a silent partner at the moment, but you might interject. You are welcome to join in.
Okay.
I was just thinking there was a period when I think I seem to recall that you almost joined the Black Panthers or something.
Black Panther, yes.
Well, you tried to join them, but they wouldn't have you. Perhaps because you weren't black.
No, an Indian chased me out.
Who chased you out?
An Indian.
Okay. But you had a desire to join the Black Panthers.
I was in the Notting Hill Gate, and it was a West Indian area.
Right.
With a lot of manifestation.
And this would have been in the 60s?
Yes, it was in the 60s.
Okay, but you felt drawn towards this radical militant...
But I was sort of attracted by a leader, which was André Chavindon.
Uh-huh.
And he was a very good spokesman.
Right.
Spokesman
for the movement.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would imagine that some aspects of the installation might have chimed with you. You might sort of recognize aspects of this. And so was this where the two of you met? Did you both meet in London then? Or?
Yes, but not there. I mean, we happened to live in Leamington Road Villas, which of course now is an extremely expensive area.
Hmm.
There wasn't one single car in the street when we lived there.
Right.
And now you have three rows of very expensive cars and very expensive people living
there.
Because I went back to look at it one time, one day.
Okay.
No, this was, I mean, there was speculation on all the houses in that area at the time, and so it was it was a pretty drastic situation for most people who lived there.
Yeah.
They were all very poor people and, of course, living in terrible conditions, and we happened to have a flat there.
Right.
We weren't wealthy either.
No.
But
so you got a job in the film industry as a way of paying for your life as an artist, I suppose. Is that
well, just earning my living. I tried several things. I mean, I having gone through art school, I should have had the art school teachers agreed about the exam. I should have had the national diploma, and we couldn't because they closed the room, so we couldn't do the exam.
Okay.
And so I couldn't go on to London University afterwards, which I had been selected for.
Right.
And so I had to earn my living all my studies as well. So I don't know how many professions I did then.
Okay.
And then afterwards, there were several things I thought of. I thought perhaps theatre design, but when I saw the usual kind of backdrops you had to paint and so on, that wasn't very promising. Then I couldn't go into publishing because I hadn't been to university, and I couldn't go to university because I couldn't afford the fees. And so in the end, it was a little bit by chance. I thought if I worked in the film industry, that I'd work with sound and picture, and I didn't know anything about the subject, so at least I'd learn something.
Right, right. And so what period is this roughly? What year are we talking about?
60... I was in art school until 64, I think.
Oh, okay.
So it was 64 I started to work in the film industry.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, I suppose so the following years would have been a kind of heyday for experimental film, I suppose. The setting up of the film co-op and the arts lab and all this sort of 66
yes,
and so on.
Yes, but I didn't really have anything to do with that because apart from going to Bob Cobbins' screenings in a bookshop on Charing Cross Road, which was called Better Books, and there I saw experimental film. But apart from doing that, I had nothing to do with the London Filmmakers Co-op because when you're working in the industry, your amount of hours you work in a day, and I should say in a week because you worked all Saturday and all Sunday very often, didn't allow you to do anything else.
Right, right. Okay.
Well, it was very hard. I mean, it probably still is, but it's a different kind of profession now. I mean, now people sit in rooms and press buttons.
Yes.
Whereas there you were in rooms which were below a certain temperature. Mm-hmm. You were carrying cans which were a certain weight.
Yeah.
And
so was it not so there was this sort of period when you were actually working in the industry, but the kind of you had this sort of upsurge of interest in what was called underground film at the time, or and then so there must have been a period where you were absorbing these things going on.
And seeing these, they're mainly American, but also you had Jean Genet's film, which of course was banished and prohibited and censored in France, and of course censored in the United States.
This in Chant d'Amour.
Yes, you could you could see that at Better Books, for instance, because Bob Cobbing had brought it over so that the copy wouldn't be seized in the United States. So the interest of that was, I mean, the reason why I went there was to look at the underground poetry, which is what the which is what the bookshop specialized in. But then I realized there was also a screening in the back room, and most of the people who went to those screenings were fine artists. They were painters, they were sculptors, they weren't filmmakers. And so as that was due to my background as a painter, as a fine artist, that I went to those screenings as a part of that.
Right.
It was a part of the art world.
Yeah, yeah.
And the interesting thing there was that I saw that you could work on film as an independent artist. You didn't have to work with a team like I was in the industry with every single job was very specified. I mean, you were either an editor or you were a scriptwriter or you were a director. There you could completely control your way of working.
Right.
And so that sort of stayed in the back of my mind. But I didn't go there because I wanted to be a filmmaker. But that, of course, stayed in the back of my mind.
Right.
So that when I had a chance to experiment with some ideas I had, of course, that...
But that was presumably much later when you got to Avignon.
Yeah.
That's when you... So in effect...
I didn't make any films in England.
No. Okay. So then you moved to Avignon, but there is a sort of... There must have been a point where it must have had a strong impression on you to start up the Archives of Experimental Film in Avignon.
Well,
must have been, which has become...
There's quite a space between those two things.
Yeah.
In the sense that when we went to France... for all sorts of reasons. I mean, we were a little bit fed up about having tiny space to work, and I wanted to leave the film industry because you worked so much you couldn't do anything else. So when I went to Avignon, first of all, I started to work as a painter and as a sculptor, but a little bit in a vague sort of way because I wasn't quite sure where I was going to go, and I wasn't very interested in fighting in the art market.
No, okay.
That was also a very commercial, you know, between the industry, the film industry, which is very commercial, and then the art market, which is very commercial.
Right.
I wasn't very keen of either of them, I seem to remember that from the screenings I'd seen in Better Books. And also while I was editing in London, I saw that there were things that were done in those films which you couldn't do in films which you were editing for the industry. You had to always work in a fairly usual way. There were practices which you had to observe, which
sort of conventions, you might say.
Yeah, oh, which had been developed over a long period.
Right.
I mean, one example, for instance, is that I was working on a film with a director who wanted the film cut in a certain way. It couldn't be cut in that way, given what he had filmed. Oh. So I put it back together again, and I rang up another editor who was very well known, who was older than me, and I told him, I said, come and help me, because the way the director wants this cut, it doesn't work as far as I can see, mm-hmm. and let me know what you think you can do with it. So he came back, and he said, well, he cut it exactly the same way. I mean, every single splice was in exactly the same frame. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I'm going to tell him that the way you've done it is the only way it can be done.
Right.
So that made me realize that with a certain amount of experience, given the situation, given all the demands of the way a film had to look when it was projected, you more or less had to do the same thing.
I see, yes, okay, So it became, sounds a bit like paint by numbers almost. There was a method which could not be...
Well, you could edit looking out of the window in some cases.
Right.
You just ask the editor, you know, the director, how long he wanted something and what kind of thing he wanted, and he'd say vaguely, and... luckily, I mean, I have no training in film whatsoever. Luckily, that being a fine artist and being very visually orientated, I was able to, even not knowing the rules, maybe sometimes I didn't do it exactly the way it should be done. Mm. I don't know. But on the whole, they were pleased with what I'd done.
Right.
Without too much effort.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I didn't work too... It was just a question of time. I mean, very often they would say... Mm. And one of the reasons why I had a lot of work was that, you know, they'd say I want it for Wednesday, or I'd tell them, like, you can have it for Wednesday.
Yeah.
Sometimes I had to kill myself to get it done for Wednesday, but it was always done when they came, so they were very pleased.
So then, so what happened, why the move to Avignon? What sort of prompted you to get out of the film industry and move?
Well, one of the things is Alain was... he was a language assistant in Queen Mary at London University, and also doing some degrees, doctorates and things like this, and he wanted to write. So we were in an English speaking country. He wanted to write in French.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing is, I come from South America, and the weather here is usually raining, as it has last week.
Okay, yeah.
And your relation to the countryside isn't the same.
Right.
I mean, I'm used to having an avocado tree in my garden and cycling up the mountains. And And also having a much warmer climate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought we'd go back to France. We thought there'd be more space. You know, we're a little bit fed up for an artistic practice to live in such a small space.
Yeah.
You know, you have to move your things from the table in order to eat and so forth.
Yeah.
And so we looked at the map and we thought, there are not many people in Bourgogne, for instance.
Yeah.
So we'll go there. And we went to Bourgogne. It was absolutely freezing. Everybody was behind houses with big, thick walls. You know, they were sort of castles. It's very beautiful. I mean, you have lots of very fine medieval towns, which are magnificent. They still are. So we said, right, well, that's not for us, because I don't see how you could have any relation with this sort of situation, because that's not the kind of situation we're able to contact. And
so
that's why we went south. And then when we went south, we did it in a very systematic way. We visited all the southeast and all the southwest. We looked at all the towns. It was also a question of cost. It had to find somewhere to live which wasn't too expensive. And then we took odd jobs until we could do something else.
Yeah.
I delivered mail on a bicycle. I cleaned buildings.
Hmm.
Alain moved great crates in the big fruit and vegetable market. Yes, from one in the morning till one at lunchtime.
So, but when did this ambition to I mean, because you have been likened almost to, in a sort of way, bracketed with Jonas Mekas. You're like a kind of a pioneer of purist cinema. This sort of almost like a crusade for experimental film. I mean, when did that start to take hold? You know, when did you think, oh, this is what I'm going to do now?
Well, I never thought this is what I'm going to do. What happened was that I remembered some of the films I'd seen, and what I was seeing on the screen didn't seem to correspond to what was on the strip of film. And I was interested in that. I was interested in just purely for my own curiosity, how that worked. So what I did is I found some transparent spacing, 16 mil. I found an office puncher, makes holes in the film. I found some felt tip pens, and I drew lines on the transparent spacing, and I punched holes at different intervals, and I made loops out of this. I found an old projector, and then studied the result. And what I could see is that within the range of, let's say, between 2, 3, 4, 5 frames, those frames overlapped on the screen, whereas they didn't overlap on the film. In other words, if you had a different image on frame 1, frame 2, frame 3, given certain types of image, what you would have on the screen is all those three images would be perceived at the same time.
Right. Okay.
And so that intrigued me. And so I went away and got a whole lot of books on perception to find out how the perceptive system worked. And there I found out that your perceptive system, in fact, processes images at different time lengths according to what they are.
Oh, right.
And so they overlap. And that's why we see a general, an image which is continuous, whereas in fact your perceptive system is being stimulated intermittently.
Right. Is this what used to be called persistence of vision, or is it, because that's a bit discredited now, isn't it?
Yes, because they tried to show that it was on the retina, that the image was reproduced, if you like.
Right.
That comes from an experiment in the 1960s or 70s. I've forgotten the name of the scientist now. But he put a rabbit in front of a square window with bars on it and made the rabbit stare at the bars. And then afterwards sacrificed the rabbit and looked at his retina. And so what you had on the retina, I think it's called rhodopsin, you have it's a red chemical in your retina. The part where it was light had been bleached out and the dark bars remained.
Yeah.
So that was repeated on the cells.
Right.
But only for that. I mean, that's not the whole story.
I see. So the suggestion is that the visual impact, or whatever you call it, is somehow recorded on the eye.
It's traced on the retina.
And not in the brain.
And the retina is a whole lot of cells.
Right.
Now, all those cells are specialized. I mean, some of them distinguish lines, some of them see colors. The center is what focuses. And so it's a much more complicated process than that. Let's be simplified. They would say, I suppose you could say persistent of vision in a sense, but it's not, it's too simplified. Because it's in fact in your optical lobe at the back of your head, which that takes place.
Uh-huh.
So between the retina and there's a long process. It goes from synapse to synapse to synapse.
Okay. So this is what you became interested in.
Well, I wanted to see how it worked.
Right.
And but that was nothing to do with organizing an archive of everybody else's film.
Right.
So it's only after I started to make a few films to test that, very simple things with squares or circles to start with, and afterwards with the tree which was outside our house. It's only after I started to make a few films and they started to get programmed. But that was sort of separate from...
But you were making these film loops at this time, which I don't think they've been publicly shown, have they? They're not...
Well, they weren't
for sort of public consumption...
I think you can have one in Lycon in Paris to distribute my films.
Okay.
It's not as good as the original ones, but the original ones got ripped up when I was giving classes on how that worked.
I mean, the first film that I am aware of yours was Parcel.
Yeah.
Which you very quickly... I mean, that's the only one that sort of distributed, which sort of seems to have some... which is entirely abstract. That's just a sort of... It's like a little black... circle within a square and a triangle and so on.
I haven't brought the drawing along here, but I actually have it here in London.
Right.
It was an invitation for a gallery, which was a black square, and in the middle there was a tiny little white square. So I used that as the place to put my little circles and squares in the middle.
Okay.
And they were yellow, red, and blue.
Right.
And so I was substituting them at different rhythms to produce on the screen. So what you have in that film is you have, for instance, a little black square which is changing colors.
Yeah.
In the middle of a yellow square which is changing with other colors.
Right.
In the middle of another color.
Yeah.
And of course, all those things are done in succession.
Right.
But they appear on the screen simultaneously.
And is that your earliest film, earliest sort of distributed film, really?
It's one of the, yes, it's one of the earliest distributed. I did some other things which at the beginning I distributed, but which since I've been able to do.
And that's what, sort of 1978 or something, 76?
I think that was, 78 would be the film on the water wheel. That'd be 79.
Okay, right. All right. So, again, I sort of I suppose I'm returning to this question of when it kind of became more of a
Well, the thing is,
it wasn't as simple as you didn't just sort of stay in your studio beavering away at films to sort of and hope.
Well, I spent a lot of time doing that too.
Yeah,
but what it comes to is, if you want to see an experimental film, you have to make an effort.
Right.
And so one of the reasons, you either have to organize the screenings yourself, or you have to travel to where the screenings are organized.
Mm-hmm.
So I did do quite a lot of traveling to see what was going on, but I also started to show other people's films.
Right.
And the reason for showing other people's films is that I wanted to see them. And then, of course, you get into a whole lot of work, which is organizing a screening, mm-hmm. making a poster, charging people to come and see it so you can pay the rent of the films, and even organizing the space, because there weren't spaces which were organized for that. So, you know, you would have to move the chairs and find a way to have a screen and, you know, make it, black it out. And so that started to be quite a lot of work. But I realized you can't just show films like that. And at one point, I think we did that for about 6 years, and there were no grants available in those 6 years, so we had a very hard time. And then eventually the government changed, and there was money for culture, which wasn't available otherwise, I mean previously. And there we were, suddenly, the money we'd asked for, the grants we'd asked for, we had a positive answer.
Right.
And so then we thought, what can we do with this money which has suddenly arrived, which we didn't expect to have? We were ready to abandon screening films.
Oh, really?
Because otherwise we didn't eat. You
right.
know, we were already not eating very well, but that was really a limit.
Yeah.
And so then we realized as well that the political situation could change and that eventually maybe that money wouldn't be available. So we started to form a collection of films. First of all, you have to realize that in France it was a pretty desperate situation. There were no films available, hardly, to run screenings. So we started collecting classics so people could see them.
This is you and Alan.
Yeah.
And had you formed the archive at this point? Then it was a formal sort of entity.
Yes, you have to declare it at the department. You have to declare it in the official journal. You have to pay a certain amount of money to do so.
Yeah.
And you have to have statutes. Do you say statutes?
Statutes, I think.
Statutes.
Possibly.
Which governs the association.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a whole lot of administration involved.
And then you had to, you set out to buy, you have to purchase these prints then from filmmakers?
We purchased the films from the filmmakers, or from their right holders if the filmmaker was dead.
Right. So in Avignon, they built up this kind of archive and a collection of experimental films.
Yes, we had nearly 200 16mm prints from 13 different countries.
Right.
Going from 1921 to the 1990s.
And this was probably quite unique in France? Was this the only place?
It was the only archive like that, yes.
Right.
Except the Centre Pompidou, which came a little bit afterwards.
Hmm.
They have a magnificent collection of experimental films.
Right, right.
As well.
Okay.
But
yeah.
But they're, of course, a big, big museum. And
yes.
Some of their films that they have are the same that we had.
Yeah.
But they have lots of things we didn't have.
we could sort of leap forward now to the present day, just, and then we can go back again. But you are here now in London for a month. The two of you have come to London.
Yeah.
At the invitation, I think, of, is it Anat Pick?
Yes.
Who is senior lecturer in film at Queen Mary's University.
Yes.
She I think, organized an event last year to do with, was it Screening Nature?
Yes.
And then again, you've come back and you've had a screening at Tate Modern last week, a program of your own films and a program of films from the archive.
Yes.
So this is over what?
Some of them. There were other films as well which went from the archives.
So this is sort of over a 30-year period, basically. We've gone forward 30 years to where it is now, where you have screenings at Tate Modern. So, how has that been? I mean, perhaps you could talk briefly about the screening at Tate Modern. You had a whole program of films, which included the... or perhaps I'll leap backwards. Let's go backwards again. I shall read something out regarding a film you made, I think, in 1982, called Retour d'un repère composé.
Oui.
And this attracted a fair bit of attention. It was sort of here in Britain, the sort of Peter Guidall and specifically a writer called Lisa Cartwright.
Yes, it was actually shown at St. Martin's School of Art at the invitation of Malcolm LeGrice.
Okay, when was that? In 80?
I don't remember the year now.
Okay, never mind. But that's
I should have brought.
That's all right.
We'd have to bring a whole curriculum vitae to answer all those.
Yes. Okay.
All those questions.
Well, I'll read out briefly from this. This is the issue of Screen, which came out in December 1984, and this is from a piece by Lisa Cartwright. And in actual fact, in this essay, she's taking Jonathan Rosenbaum to task. He wrote He wrote this book called I can't remember. It is listed here somewhere. But she's basically reacting against this male kind of hierarchy, patriarchy, whatever one wants to call it. And your film is described in the book as the most rigorous film of its kind to Rosenbaum's knowledge. And again, briefly in conversation with Guidall at the end of the book, as the most rigorous film of its kind. One would think it merits more discussion than that in a book on avant-garde film. What kind of film is it? It is an avant-garde, experimental and materialist feminist film. It is rigorous in that it works in a total way against the repositioning of meaning, with its basis in sexual division at every level. Retour d'un repère composé works against the meaning of good movie making, and so on. Retour d'un repère composé proceeds from the most banal rules for good movie making by challenging the logical connection between an image and the object which that image represents. So, Lisa Cartwright and Peter Guidall, they sort of seem to be united in this. It represented a break, I suppose, from American cinema and also American film, I should say, American experimental film, and also male-dominated experimental film. Could you talk a little bit about this particular film?
Yes. Well, very often my work is said to be near the American structuralist films,
right,
which, as you know, are very often planned before they are. I mean, the way the filmmaker is going to make the images are planned before. Very often there's a kind of script, visual script beforehand, and then they carry it out. You know, they decide to print a certain amount of frames and so on.
Yeah.
This isn't exactly made the same way. It's made in a very haphazard way in comparison. I don't plan ever what I'm going to do until I look at the scene, for instance, for a start. And that means that I can go and look at something and I don't like it because the weather isn't right or anything, and I go away, or I decide I can't do something useful there, something useful cinematographically there. And so I don't do what I thought I might have been able to do. That film has a picture of a branch of a tree. It's an old tree, which unfortunately is now being cut down, in the park next to the Pope's Palace in Avignon. There was an old cafe there, which was very nice. It had a those old green metal tables like you find in Renoir's paintings. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the cafe has updated itself. Those tables are no longer there. The tree is no longer there. Mm. Anyway, I spent all day filming the leaves on this. There's several rotations the way it's filmed. It's filmed according to a pantoon, mm-hmm. which is a sort of poetic meter of some sort. It's a poetic Malaysian poetic meter. It's again, I haven't got a drawing to show you, but what the way it works is that you have three elements. You go forward to a fourth one and you drop one element, and then you go to another one and you drop one element. So you sort of advance, dropping one.
Okay.
And so the way I'm filming as far as moving in the space of that branch is that I'm filming, let's say, I think there are, I forget how many, 13 focus points. So I'll film the first focus point, and then I'll go to the third one, which is a bit further away, and I'll come back to the second one. And then I'll go to the fourth one, and I'll come back again. And so I go right to the end. So what you've got is a rotation of focus points.
Right.
Which, of course, on the screen will appear simultaneously.
Right.
There's also a rotation of what the sun is doing, because the sun moves around. That took all day to do a three-minute reel. And so as the sun moves around, the sun falls on the branch and on different leaves in different ways as it goes around. Then I also made some choices about when to film, because there's a pond there, and there were people in bright colored clothes that walked by sometimes. So to make it a little less green everywhere, mm-hmm. I purposely filmed when there were people in red dresses or yellow dresses going by. So there was a slight subjective thing, but there was a way of working.
Mm.
But one doesn't know what's going to happen. But that's only 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So when the reel came back, and I looked at it, I thought, gosh, in 3 minutes you can't see anything, you know. So I sent off to the lab again and asked them to make me 8 reels. So you have the same thing 8 times.
Right.
And then you can look at it a little bit better. But when it came back, the colors went right. It was either too red or too blue. And I had a screening in London at the London Filmmakers Co-op where I was supposed to show this film. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? I'll take the two reels, the red one and the blue one, and I'll project them together on top of each other. So then maybe I'll have something a little bit more interesting.
Right.
So that produces one kind of thing. But of course, when you do that, your definition is a little less good, your focus is a little less good, your color is a little less good.
Mm.
And so that was one stage. And then the next stage, I thought, well, that's not very practical, because then every time people got to have two projectors, it's not going to get screened very often. What happens if I'm in the lab and we print them on top of each other?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the lab and had a grader, who was very interested in this kind of work because he wanted to do something more than just grading. And so we printed a red version and we printed a blue version, but we put the blue version one frame back.
Right.
So there's another rotation.
Right.
And 8 times.
Right.
So then the film's 59 minutes long.
Yeah.
And so then I thought, well, I don't ask him anymore, but he suggested we do it a third time.
Okay.
So we've got a red, a blue, and a green,
mm-hmm.
each time one frame back.
Right.
And so we've got a lot of rotations there. We've got a rotation on the space that's been filmed.
Mm.
We've got a rotation of the sun going round, and we've got a rotation because the image is slightly moved one frame each time for the different prints.
Yeah, and this resulted in, is that a 59-minute film?
It's a 59-minute film.
As a result, does it repeat itself? I mean, is it a recurring? Does the same
each,
3 minutes?
Section, each section is 8 times.
Right.
Exactly the same 8 times.
Exactly the same 8 times. So as you're watching the film, you're actually seeing something 8 times, one after the other.
Yes, you're seeing 8 times the same thing, and then you're seeing 8 times with 2 colors, and then you're seeing 8 times with 3 colors.
Okay.
Or 3 gradings, 3 different gradings.
Right.
And then I met the director of the lab, who said that if everyone was like me, the lab would close.
Right.
Which might be the case, it did close.
And how did you, what do you think about this, the way that it was regarded in this way, as being this sort of what do you call it, apotheosis or apotheosis of avant-garde film at the time. It was sort of held as being an exemplary, almost the way forward, but
It is sort of radical. I mean, I don't think I'd dare to make something 59 minutes like that anymore.
No.
It is radical. It's a pity that, I mean, I haven't been able to make another copy, you know, and the colors are going.
Oh, right.
And it would be very expensive to redo it, you know, 59. Uh-huh. But I wasn't thinking about gender. I wasn't thinking about what other filmmakers were doing. I was really interested in what I was studying about perception,
right,
and to see how far I could take it, because my interest, of course, was to try and enlarge the possibilities of filmmaking.
Right.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
And then later on in my filmmaking, I not only tried to expand what one can do with film, but also to try and deal with subjects which I think are relevant for today.
Right. So
I go from the ordinary tree in the park, which has been cut down, to maybe a farm, which is an organic farm, because I think that's the right way to...
So the subject matter in your later films, then, is more significant, perhaps? The content of what you're reproducing has a significance.
Well, it has a social, political, and economical.
Right. So you're choosing subjects like organic farms or flowers or whatever it might be, or even I think more recently, even examples of sort of industrial waste, aren't they? I think I'm looking at the program of your films. I think one of them seemed to be much more straightforward, but it was
Quid pro quo with the nuclear station.
No, a much later one, which is very static, but it looks like something floating on the surface of water. It could
That's
be.
The sea salt flower.
Oh, is it?
Yes, that's,
oh, okay.
That's sea salt.
I misinterpreted it. I thought it was oil or something.
No. It's
completely the wrong impression.
It's a sea salt. The sea salt flower floats on the top of the salt pan, and that's gathered first.
Right.
And then afterwards you gather the salt, which is the grey salt, as they call it, underneath, which you use for cooking. The sea salt on the top, sea salt flour, as they call it.
Right.
That you use to put on your food like that.
But in Quid pro quo, there are references to sort of industrial waste and nuclear.
Yes, well, in Quid pro quo, it's a film about how to find a balance between technology and nature.
Right.
So that's how you have pictures of nature, but you also have pictures of nuclear station and oil tanks and and oil refinery.
Right, it's interesting because briefly, I'll mention that when I had seen Goodall's article in Studio International first of all, and I was attracted to the sort of purism of his position, this kind of radical structural materialist film. And then I sort of read the article in Screen in about whenever it was, 1984 or something, maybe 1982. And so to read that Goodall and Lisa Cartwright describing your films in this way, it was almost as though you had taken it to a beyond this position. And so I was very fascinated by this. And so I approached you.
There's some common ground between what Goodall, I think, intends to do, because as you know, his films, he always wants the audience to try and figure out what is there.
Right.
And it's what's on the screen which is important, not, you know, you're not telling someone a story of what to think or anything.
Yeah.
And for that he's very good, because really you do have to look at the screen to find out what it is.
Yeah.
Both cinematographically and what he might be filming. But what he might be filming seems to be much more unimportant than the process that he's using.
Right.
Because you're supposed to...
But there is an elimination of content to some extent.
Well, there's an elimination of representative items.
Right. Yeah.
Except very occasionally you'll see it's a phone or you'll see it's an aeroplane.
Right.
But that isn't... It's not a film about an aeroplane or about a phone.
No. Well, we should sort of mention that... You are listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. I should remind listeners of that occasionally. And on Wednesday, the 5th of February, at the Horse Hospital, Colonnade, Bloomsbury, London WC1 N1JD, Russell Square Tube, 7 o'clock. We will be showing a film of Rose Lauder in her tiny Paris flat preparing a macrobiotic meal made by myself and Sandra Cross, plus hopefully two rarely screened films by Rose. Rose will be present at the screening, as will Anat Pick, because I've contacted her and she's prepared to do a question and answer afterwards. And all of that will be as a benefit for Resonance 104, because benefit fundraising week is coming up soon. So that's Wednesday the 5th of February at the Horse Hospital. Rose, your latest films all tend to they've all a lot of them use a music soundtrack, which is a sort of bit of a what should we call it, a breakthrough for you, or not a breakthrough, but a diversion?
A change.
A change, exactly, that's the word. I was trying to think of a more complicated word instead of change. But, they're all by someone called De Grenier, is that right?
Yeah, Alexis.
Alexis De Grenier.
Yeah.
So was it about your last four or five films all have soundtracks by De Grenier?
Yes. I can't remember if all of them do, but...
Okay, certainly yes. Some of them.
But again, things happen by chance, you know, it's not planned. Yeah. I didn't decide suddenly to have music on my films.
No.
I met Alexis because he lived in Avignon, and I went to one of his concerts, and then we discussed, and he was very keen to work with me. Uh-huh. So as soon as we decided to work together, then, of course, when I filmed, I bore in mind that that might have sound.
Right.
And then what we tended to do is I tended to go and film without telling him what I was going to do because I didn't know what I was going to do. Mm. And then when I would finally come back with it, we'd look at it together, and then he'd go away and compose, and then he'd bring me what he'd done, and then we'd discuss if anything had to be changed or anything. But on the whole, we didn't change anything, hardly.
Right. I was interested to hear at the Tate Modern Talk, you there was one film by someone called Looney.
Katie O'Looney.
Katie O'Looney, sorry.
She did the music for Quiproquo, the first film which was shown, yes.
And I think during the question and answer, you mentioned that you had almost hoped that it had been less synchronized. You had asked her to do a soundtrack.
Yeah.
And in a way, you were slightly disappointed that it
I'd asked her to do a soundtrack, to compose a soundtrack which was a good piece of music for herself in
right.
music terms, and not a secondary accompaniment of the image.
Right.
And literally gave her a copy of the film and a projector.
Yeah.
And told her to get on with it. And then we just dropped the sound in. I mean, she composed the entire thing in her studio.
Right.
And we didn't change anything.
Yeah.
But I do notice that in the film there are some points when the train goes by or something like that, there's a slight attempt to make some kind of synchronization, which...
And you would prefer that to not be the case? You would rather...
Well, as far as filmmaking goes, I mean, I could say the same thing for images. What I'm trying to do for the moment is I like to be surprised. I mean,
right.
in any artwork, I don't want to... this is a problem with a lot of feature films. I know exactly what's going to happen. I know exactly where they're going to cut. I know exactly where the light is. And sometimes I can even see the mic.
Yeah.
And I think in an artwork, one really needs to be taken where one wouldn't go normally.
Right.
Which means life is like that. We don't know what's going to happen.
Mm.
Mm. And so I think an artwork,
apart from death and taxes, they say. Anyway.
Even that might disappear.
Let's hope so, yeah.
Well, I'm always ready to be surprised because nothing in my life, I mean, the way my life has gone, none of it was preconceived. So
Right.
I'm ready... And so in music, I expect the music that interests me is things that are happening which I don't expect to happen and surprised. And that's not easy to do.
Right.
You know, if you see a scene and you think, now I'm going to try and film it in a way where anyone looking at what I'm able to record when we finally project it, they're not going to know where it's going. It's extremely difficult to do.
Yeah. And what's the future of the archives then? Because it's not your collection has been. Is it still intact? I mean, do you still?
Yes, it's still intact. There's no problem. The prints are in magnificent condition because. Because there was only me who projected them. We don't lend them out. We don't let anyone screen them. But we had to stop working in Avignon, partly because all the cinemas, all the commercial cinemas have gone digital. Uh-huh. So you can't put a 60mm projector in the in the cabinet anymore.
What, not in any of them?
In hardly any of them.
Okay.
They're all digital, even the Cinémathèque Française.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You go there, you'll have a digital image on the screen.
Wow.
Which is really disappointing, because if even they can't project things in the original, you can go to Centre Pompidou, you'll see still film projected.
Okay.
In some places you can see that, and if you go, of course, to Lycone or to Scratch, which is run screening, which is run in a cinema in Paris once a month, that's still screened on film.
Right.
But how long that will go on, we don't know.
Yeah.
So what I did is I moved the, first of all, the document collection, because it's an enormous paper document collection. I moved that to Lycone, who had already quite a lot of documents. So those documents are available to the public, but especially to students doing research, journalists, programmers, people writing theses, people writing books.
Yeah.
So that's open to anyone who you just have to tell them beforehand. And
but this was a sort of document collection that you the two of you had amassed over 30 years.
Oh, yes,
like
I bought. I bought with public funds.
Yeah. And why did you think it necessary to move it all to Paris? Why was it sort of...
Well, it was a bit absurd. We were having people writing a thesis and they were coming from Paris to Avignon. And then where the documents were, there was no one to even show them where they were. I mean, I'd have to go from my house to where they were.
Right.
And I'd have to probably direct their thesis as well, because the teacher in Paris won't have told them how to even use an index.
Right, right.
And so I was doing the teacher's work.
Yeah.
And it was also... So you couldn't do it. I mean, you were...
But the films will stay in Avignon?
No, the films have been
moved.
The
films have gone as well?
The films have gone to Lycone as well.
Okay.
So the only thing that has changed, I mean, they're not distributed with, they're not rented out like the films in Lycone's collection.
Yeah.
They are a collection which can only be shown in one place, just like they were shown in one place in our place.
Right.
So the only thing that's changed is their screening place.
Okay.
And so Lycone, in their Scratch projection, can screen those films amongst the other films that they program, which they'll do every now and then. So it was a way to preserve the rights of filmmakers, preserve the films, and to allow them to be shown.
Right, right.
Because if you gave them to a museum, the person who is head of the film department of the museum changes all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And their rules change all the time. You can't trust them. So,
and what about the digital future? Does that have any interest for you at all? Will you continue to work with film?
Well, I think I'll go on working with film as long as there is any film. You know, I'm starting to be an old person, so I don't know whether film will stop before I disappear or otherwise.
Right.
And you can't do what I'm doing on film on digital.
You don't think so?
No.
You couldn't do it?
No, you can't do the same thing because it's working on the frame-by-frame film system.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean to say you can't do interesting things on digital.
No.
And a lot of filmmakers have gone to digital. But a lot of the filmmakers who worked on film and did some very good work on film, the work they've done on digital is much less interesting.
Right.
Quite a few of them. And some of them have given up after a while.
Yeah.
So you can't just... you also have to be equipped. I'm not equipped, and I haven't the means either to go out and buy a whole lot of digital equipment.
So you'll continue to work with film for as long as you can, and the laboratories are still—you can still get it processed in France and so on.
Well, for the moment, there's still a laboratory which is doing it.
Okay,
that will be the problem.
Right. Yeah. Alan, anything you wish to add?
No, it's okay.
It's okay. You've remained as the silent partner, which was also the title of Iggy Dale film, I think. Silent partner, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All right. I think we could probably play out with some more sound poetry. We started with a track by Lily Greenham, who was a sort of an associate of Bob Cobbing. She was a female sound poet. Did you remember that? Did you hear it? It was sort of some of it was in French.
Well, maybe when you play it, I'll remember it.
It was right at the beginning of the programme. But
I remember some pieces at the beginning of the programme. I've heard that before.
Right. Let's see if I can find it. Track two. Here we go. This must be...
But you're going back a long way. I mean, Bob Conley was...
Well, yes. The 60s. Yeah. 1966.
Early 60s.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, this is a thank you very much to Rose Lauder and Alan Alcide Souda for coming into the studio. You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. And just to reiterate that on Wednesday, the 5th of February, at the Horse Hospital, London WC1N1JD, Rose will be present at a screening of a documentary of her preparing a macrobiotic meal, plus two rarely screened films to be chosen. We haven't decided on those yet. I thought maybe Couleur Mécanique, perhaps, or something more ecological. I don't know. Any preferences? It would have to be something from...
Couleur Mécanique is about 16 minutes long.
Is it? That might be a bit too long for that event. But we'll have to get something from the Lux. Mm. I'd quite like to show Parcel, because I imagine it's rarely shown.
That's 3 minutes.
Yeah, and maybe something else. Rue des Teinturiers or something?
No, that's 31 minutes.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Okay. Well, we'll select something anyway. Yeah. So those two films might be shown as well. And that will be a benefit for Resonance. That's Wednesday, the 5th of February at the Horse Hospital. Thank you for listening. Rose has reminded me that I didn't mention the time. The screening will start at 7 o'clock. The doors will open at 6:30. And Anat Pick has agreed to do a question and answer after the screening as well. So, there we are. Yeah.